Welcome everyone to this session. So before I introduce our presenter today, so I would like to have a few reminders. The first thing is please complete the short presenter feedback survey via the Actors Institute event apps. If you haven't downloaded, you should have downloaded it by now. And also in addition to the survey, there's also a summit prize that you can enter into. So you can find, you'll find an icon called Summit Prizes inside app, and there are three different prizes that you can enter. So the presentation will go about 35 minutes, and at the end we'll leave 15 to 20 minutes Q&A time. So just remember that when you ask a question, please identify yourself and speak clearly to the microphone as well. So I knew Meng Yishu back from uni, and the two co-author of this paper, Mike Sherris, was actually my honors supervisor, and Adam Shao is one of the colleagues that I'm currently working with at MindWealth and Wellbeing. Meng Yishu is a PhD student at ARC Center of Excellence in Population Aging Research, which is called CIPA, in UNSW Business School. Her PhD thesis looks at pre-retirement investment strategies and post-retirement income solutions in the presence of housing. So she obtained her Bachelor of Commerce with honours degrees from UNSW Australia. Her honours thesis looked at systematic mortality improvement trends and mortality heterogeneity. So without further ado, please welcome Meng Yishu.
Okay, thanks for coming to my session. Hope the lunch was good. So this is one of my PhD projects. This is a joint work with Mike and Adam, as Estelle introduced. And also the theme of this conference is Think Differently. Before the session, I was thinking about a you can call it a joke. In a conference when everyone is talking about thinking differently and you think not differently, you are the different, right? But I'll still continue with how I think differently. I guess the big difference is this is a piece of academic work, whereas I noticed that a lot of presentations in this conference has an industry perspective. So I guess that's one of the difference. The other thing is more relevant to this piece of work is that this paper makes us think that home purchasing decision is actually a big component in retirement planning. So when you graduate from uni, go to find a full-time job and start thinking about when to become a homeowner, in the short run, it's about starting up your family, having kids. But in the long term, it also has a huge impact on your retirement savings. So I guess that's the second way of thinking differently on how my work think differently. All right, so let's start with the presentation. That's an outline for this presentation. As usual, start with some motivation. So why this topic matters? You guys probably aware that housing serves as a dual purpose. It's a durable consumption goods in the sense that if you own a house, you don't need to pay the rent, so you are having the housing consumption. And this housing consumption insures against rental inflation because you own the house, you stay there, you don't need to pay the rent. However, the rent goes, you are insured against. And the second purpose of housing is it's a valuable investment asset, and in fact, it is often the single largest asset in most household portfolios, in at least in Australia. So reflecting on the dual purpose of housing, it plays a crucial role in retirement planning. It protects against poverty based on this piece of work showing that renting old age is often associated with poverty. And housing is also a potential source of income. Retirees, they can unlock their home equity by reverse home equity releasing products like reverse mortgage, although it's not well developed, or by downsizing or selling the house to fund their health care and long-term care or improve their standard of living. And on top of that, based on the survey conducted by Productivity Commission, shows that a majority of retirees, they prefer age in place due to their attachment to the local community. So given the importance of housing, the dual purpose of housing and its role in retirement planning, a natural question that arises is then, when should I become a homeowner? Well, when considering this question, we start with the trade-off between the rent risk and asset price risk. If you own the house, you hedge against so you avoid the rental risk, but it also introduces the asset price risk when you want to use your house to finance your either your long-term care, health care, or want to improve your standard of living. So there's one trade-off there, and it's probably one of the biggest trade-off when you're considering when to become a homeowner. And of course, that's not the only thing to consider when you make such a big decision. Whether or not you can afford purchasing the property also depends on your labor earnings. And also before and after becoming a homeowner, it can have a huge impact on your consumption and asset allocation. And of course, it can also affect your savings for retirement. So to take into account all those factors, we need a multi-period model, so a model that lasts for maybe for a few decades of consumption and investment decisions. So how much to consume each period, how should I put my money into defensive asset, into risky assets, with the following characteristics. So with stochastic labor income, because whether or not you can afford purchasing the property depends on your labor income, stock returns, and housing costs. So there's a model called vector autoregressive process. If you are familiar with the AR process, the autoregressive process, the AR process is only capture one variable, and this vector, it captures multiple variables. So it's a suitable process because it can model different moving parts at the same time and also account for their possible correlations. So that's why we choose this VAR process to model different components. And to answer the questions, we look at how purchasing home property at different ages would affect individuals' pre-retirement consumption, retirement savings, and ultimately their lifetime utility. So you can think utility is how happy they are from consumption and how happy they are from the savings for retirement. Okay, so we'll talk more about how I set up the model in a few slides. Model setup. So the utility comes from housing service is the same regardless of the tenure choice. So whether you own the house or rent the house, the utility derived from this housing service is the same. The standard setup of budget constraints and wealth accumulation. So in each period, you decide how much you consume and put the rest in the risky asset and the defensive assets, and then you move on to the next period and do the similar decisions. The several parts in the wealth, liquid assets, cash and stocks, also the superannuation, it's of the defined contribution type, and of course this home equity. In terms of the model parameterization, we use the HILDA data, household income and labor dynamics in Australia, to capture the consumption and portfolio choice decisions for an average Australian in his or her 10-year choice. And I'll also show you more in a few slides in terms of how we parameterize those factors. All right, so that's probably the only formula in this slide. That's the standard setup. That's the expected value of the lifetime utility. So there are two components from which the utility is derived. The first component is your non-durable consumption, which forms the power utility function. And you also derive, the individual also derives utility from retirement savings. And the time horizon is from age 25 to 65, which is 40 years. So we only look at the pre-retirement stage. Okay, so in terms of housing decisions, which is the key part of this piece of work, we allow for three types of transitions. At age 25, the individual starts as a renter, and he can keep renting, or he can purchase a property, so he will become a homeowner. And once the individual becomes a homeowner, we assume that that particular individual will stay in the same property, so he can't sell the property and become renting again. So this is backed up by the low transition rates from the HILDA data. So we think this is a reasonable assumption. So in terms of the rent-to-own decision, we say the individual can choose to purchase the house at those different ages, 30, 40, 50, 60, and over 65. The last age bracket means the individual will keep renting throughout the working life. So whenever the individual decides to purchase a property, this down payment required, which is at least 20% of the property value, and the rest is financed by the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. So chances are that at those ages, when the individual wants to purchase the property, he or she may not have sufficient savings. And in those cases, we assume they'll keep renting and make the purchasing decision again in 10 years' time. So for example, if at age 30, the individual say, well, I want to become a homeowner, and then he doesn't have any sufficient fund to make the down payment, then he'll keep renting for the next 10 years and go back to this decision again in age 40. So that's how we set up this model framework. Okay, so a few words on how we parameterize the consumption decision and the portfolio choice decision. We use the HILDA data to find what is the average behavior for a renter and the average behavior for a homeowner. So this is the consumption decision, and this is in terms of the proportion of disposable income. We see that, well, there are two lines, one for the homeowner and one for the renter. So we see that the gap is closing as they become older. And the next slide shows the asset allocation decision, which is the how much you put in the equity and how much you put in the cash. We use two components to decide the asset allocation decision. One is whether or not you participate in the equity market, and that's shown on the left-hand side. And the other thing is, given that you participate in the equity market, how much you put in the equity market. The reason why we do that is because when we analyze the data, we found a big mess at zero. That's why we separate them out. So you can see that given the equity market participation, the difference between renter and owner is hard to tell without the label, right? But if you look at the equity participation rate, there's a big difference between homeowner and renter. And these two slides are all based on the empirical data. All right, so far we talk about how we set up the model, how we parameterize the factors in the model. So what we did afterwards is we throw the model into the computer and ask the computer to do the simulation for us. In the next few slides, I'll show you the results from our simulations. Okay, so if you recall the utility function, the utility comes from two sources. One is the non-housing consumption, and the other one is the savings for retirement. So this slide shows the average non-housing consumption for different group of people. So different group is decided by when they become a homeowner. And the last bracket means they keep renting throughout their working life. So if you look at the patterns for homeowners, i.e. those who become homeowner before age 65, so the general pattern is similar. There's a dramatic drop after they purchase the property. That's because of the 20% down payment. The 20% down payment is a huge proportion to their accumulated wealth. And of course, this huge drop is followed by quick recovery. And if you look at this, the line with dots, that's the group of people who keep renting throughout their working life. Before age 30, the average consumption is similar among those groups. But if you look at age after age 60, approaching retirement, they spend the least amount compared to other groups. So that's the two observations from this graph. And apart from non-housing consumption, another big part of consumption is housing costs. Renters, they need to pay the rent. Homeowners, they need to repay the mortgage. And of course, they also incur some home maintenance costs. The left-hand side shows the rental payment, whereas the right-hand side shows the mortgage repayment. So if we start from the left-hand side, for the 65-plus group, they pay the highest amount of rental costs and also for a longer period. And in terms of the mortgage repayment, of course, the earlier they purchase the home, the lower the house value and the lower the amount of mortgage. And if you compare across these two graphs, The mortgage repayment is generally lower than the rental costs, so that would affect the accumulated wealth for the retirement. If you have less outgoings, of course, your wealth for retirement is higher. Okay, so now let's move on to the second component that contributes to the lifetime utility. We just look at the non-housing consumption. The second component is wealth at retirement. So that's the total amount of wealth, which consists of liquid assets plus home equity plus superannuation or amount or pension. So we can see that the superannuation amount is the biggest component in the total wealth, followed by home equity if they become a homeowner before age 65. So a comment on pension, it's not a surprise that pension is the largest proportion, because in our model setup, we assume that once they enter into the workforce, they start accumulating, so that's 40 years of accumulation. And the home equity amount is also a large proportion, which is in line with the empirical findings. If we compare across different ages, we see that if you become a homeowner at a younger age, then your wealth is also higher. Your wealth at retirement is also higher. That's driven by higher home equity amounts, which is not a surprise because the earlier you purchase the home, the more mortgage you have paid off. That's why you have a higher net home equity value. And it's also due to a higher liquid assets amount. And if you remember in the previous slides, when we compare the housing costs, I comment that if you become a homeowner earlier, you repay the mortgage, and the mortgage repayment is usually lower than the rental costs. And another factor that contributes to a higher liquid assets is this asset allocation decision. Once you become a homeowner, you tend to put more assets in the risky asset, and the risky asset tend to give you a higher rate of return. That's why these several factors contribute to a higher liquid assets amount, which leads to a higher average wealth at retirement. Okay, so now let's look at the most important piece is when to become a homeowner. So we answer this question by looking at which age that contributes to the highest amount of lifetime utility. And since the number of utility itself is negative and it's hard to interpret, so we transform the number into a certainty equivalent consumption, which you can think represents how much I spend every year that gives me the same amount of utility as if I purchased the house at those different ages. So the higher the annual income level, of course, the better, or the higher the utility and the better you feel. Okay, so roughly there are three groups. If you purchase the property earlier, say age 30, 40, although you have a higher wealth, but the discounted utility from consumption is lower. Because if you recall that that graph shows the average non-housing consumption, there's a huge drop every time the individual becomes a homeowner, right? And that's the earlier you become a homeowner, the larger the discount its impact. So these two factors combined gives us a quite low utility level or the certainty equivalent consumption level. On the other hand, if the individual defers the purchase to age 50 or 60, they enjoy the benefits of being a homeowner at a lower cost. And on the other end of the spectrum is renting throughout working life. That significantly constrains the spending because of this high rental costs, and it also slows down the wealth accumulation. That's why it gives a quite low certainty equivalent consumption level. So this next slide gives you a more direct illustration in terms of how this consumption drop after you purchase the property affects your overall utility level. So you can think it's a heat map. The darker the color, the lower the utility. So the darker, the worse. And this x-axis represents the age. The y-axis represents the age at which you become a homeowner. So if you look at the very first row, it's very dark here, right? So that's caused by this huge consumption drop. And, well, if you become a homeowner at age 40 or 50, you also incur this consumption drop and hence the utility loss. But because we are looking at the discounted value, so if you discount all the way to age 25, this utility cost is diminishing. And at age 50 or 60, you can't really see any impact. So that explains why this discounted utility from consumption, why this utility cost is so detrimental to the very first age bracket. Okay, so the next thing we did is, well, we think it will be interesting to compare our model results with the empirical data to see what are people actually doing in Australia. So we go to the ABS website and find that most Australians purchased their first home before age 45. So what does that mean? If you believe our model results, if you think, well, so that means when Australians, they make the first home purchase decision, they probably emphasize more on the retirement savings when making this decision. And of course, we need to acknowledge that the model is always a simplified version of what's happening in reality. We abstract from several real-world complications that might explain the difference between our optimal results and what are people doing in reality. Okay, so to sum up, our work looks at when is the best time to become a homeowner. So we summarize the conclusion in three parts. So if you become a homeowner earlier during the working life, say age 30, 35, that is likely to lead to a higher level of wealth at retirement because of higher home equity value and more accumulated liquid assets. And if you defer the purchase to later ages, say 55, 60, that's more attractive based on this lifetime utility theorem, because the utility loss due to the consumption cut is also deferred. Lastly, if you keep renting throughout working life, that's very unattractive both in terms of retirement wealth and utility level. That's because the the rental cost constrains spending and slows down your wealth accumulation. All right, so that's the end of my presentation. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Maggie, for your presentation. So I guess housing is quite topical at the moment. And then I just made my first purchase of my family home. And then today I learned from Maggie that I just made a suboptimal decision. But the upside is higher wealth at retirement, which I'm happy about this. So any questions from the floor? Please, there's a microphone in the middle. Please state your name and also your questions clearly, please.
Hi, this is Gary from ANU. So can we go back to your formula, please? No. Okay, so my understanding is a lot of your final conclusions, especially the certainty equivalent and the heat map, is driven from your beta, the discounting factor you have used.
Sorry, is your microphone on?
It's driven by the beta factor, which is your discounting factor.
Uh-huh.
So what beta have you used?
I believe it's not 0.96. So that's about 4% discount.
Yes. And there has been actually a lot of literature that we should not be using a discounting factor. So if you notice Estelle's presentation and my presentation, our beta factor is actually 1. And the reason for that is, as an individual, do you actually value tomorrow's consumption less than today when you go to that period? So if you make beta equals 1, I believe some of a lot of your conclusions would change significantly.
Is that all of your question?
Well, my question was, what beta have you used? And maybe you should making beta equals 1.
Sure. We should have a sensitivity analysis on that. Of course, there's a lot of debate on what beta should be. The traditional theory is, well, people are impatient, and if you have $1, you would like to consume today rather than tomorrow, right? That's where this discount factor comes from. And there's also a hyperbolic discounting theorem saying, well, people are impatient in the short run, but patient in the long run, and they use a different discount factor to do that.
So have you done sensitivity analysis?
Probably not.
Okay.
That's I think I set it to 0.98, something like that. But yeah, we'll do that. Thank you.
Can I add a comment on that? So I think Gary mentioned that we use a beta of 1. So I guess I just would like to emphasize that, because from the research that we're doing, we assume from the perspective of trustees. So we believe that it is not right for a trustee to discount the values of future utility on behalf of our members. But I guess in the case of many, he's like, it comes from a different perspective. So it's different. Yeah. Any other questions?
John Duravin, I'm just wondering if you allowed in the wealth accumulation side of things for the Australian tax situation. So in particular, assuming you're saving via superannuation, of course, the concessional nature of the tax treatment of superannuation contributions makes a big difference to what you'll calculate as the retirement lump sum according to what your marginal tax rate is.
We had a small section on the sensitivity of a tax allowing for the concessional tax treatment in the superannuation accounts, and we don't find a very significant difference if we allow for tax. When I was presenting this in the United States, people often ask, because in the United States the mortgage repayment is tax deductible, But this is not the case in Australia if this home is owner-occupied. So that's why we put a small section at the end testing the sensitivity on the tax treatment. So we don't find any significance if we allow for tax.
Thanks, Mingyi. That was interesting. Just wanted to ask a question about the utility for mortgage repayments versus rental payments. You mentioned at the start of your talk that you're treating them equally. Is there anything out there in the literature at all that would allow you to treat the utility from rental versus mortgage payments differently? Because I guess from an intuitive point of view, there's more value in a mortgage repayment because you don't have the issue of your landlord potentially kicking you out or various other factors like that. So is there anything out there that would allow you to relax that assumption?
I guess this different setup in this utility function. So alternatively, the utility can come from both non-durable consumption and housing consumption. And then it's down to the question on how you measure this housing consumption. Because in our model setup, we assume every house is the same box. Of course, it's not the case in reality. So if you assume every house is the same, then whether you own the house or rent the house, you derive the same amount of housing consumption. And another alternative is you have an extra factor to allow for the benefit from owning the property. So if you imagine if you stay in your own house, you derive more utility as if you compared to you stay in a rented house. And certainly I agree on that, but then it's down to the question on how you give the value of this particular parameter. And we find it very, very hard to parameterize this extra utility. So yeah, I guess we'll keep looking on different forms of utility function that allows for the difference of owning and renting.
Hi, Aidan Morrison from the Youngsford Initiative. Just wanted to ask about what was your assumption regarding house price growth relative to wage price growth over the period?
So everything is captured by this VAR process. I believe it was in the first order process. It's been a while and the specific details is not on top of my head now. But I have a full working paper on that. So maybe we can look at it afterwards. So I have the so what we did was gather data and estimated the model, so what the parameter values are, and then do the simulation to that fits into the later simulation part.
This is based on historical data?
That's right.
Sure. And also, did you take into consider the tax treatment of the family home itself as a capital asset, and the tax treatment of rent and imputed rent as a consumption stream or an income stream?
Can you repeat the question, the second part again?
Did you take into account the tax treatment of the family home is exempt from all capital gains tax,
mm-hmm.
whereas assets saved in superannuation or other things like that aren't completely exempt, even if they are discounted, so there could be a difference in terms of your exposure to an asset from an earlier stage that's completely exempt from capital gains tax or imputed rent, for that matter, as well. Is that part of your analysis?
So what we have in the paper is a section on the tax treatment. So we look at the concessional tax treatment for the superannuation. So essentially, the money you invested in the super has a tax benefit compared to the investment outside of the super. I think that's all we get in the paper. Yeah.
Any other another question from the floor? So I would like to ask a question to Mengi. So I noticed that the data that you use is Australian data.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, to what extent do you think that the result of your model is driven by the housing market? For example, that so Sydney versus like Darwin, of course, there's a very different implication in terms of affordability of the housing. So to what extent do you think your result will be different if you're looking at different markets?
I believe a lot of the results is driven by the fact that after you become a homeowner, you make a down payment which constrains your consumption in the following period. That's why there's a huge drop after the several years after you become a homeowner. So to the extent that the down payment is a huge proportion is a significant proportion of your accumulated wealth, I think the results will be similar if you look at different housing markets.
Any other questions from the audience? No? Okay, then please join me and thank you, Meng.
Oh, there's one more.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah.
Richard Lyon from Tau. I could ask a lot of questions, but there's one in particular that you may be able to answer. And maybe you mentioned it and I was writing something else down at the time. But why is it, given that you say it's the same box, the same house that everybody has, whether they rent or buy, why was the person renting to age 65 spending so much more on rent than anybody else? I didn't understand that, because it must drive the final outcome that you had.
Okay, so let's look at is this particular graph you're referring to, right? First of all, the rental cost is associated with the housing market performance through the rental yield.
Yeah, but my issue is the person who buys at 60
mm-hmm.
is renting until 60. And that line for 60 is way below the line for 65.
That's right.
So that's what I don't understand.
So that's in short, because whether or not they are capable of becoming a homeowner depends on the housing market movement as well. So if the housing market is quite high, then they can't afford to buy the property and they have to keep renting. And during that period, the rental cost is also very high. That's why for the very last group, this rental cost is huge. But yeah, I understand that you say that the housing market is homogenous.
Okay, so you're saying the age 65 rent all the way through is not a choice. The others were choices. This one was not a choice.
It's also a choice.
This is everybody left behind because they couldn't get in at any of those other ages.
It's a combination of them.
Right.
So for some of them, it's an active choice. And for a few others, they are forced to do that.
Right. It would have been interesting to see the difference between the active choice to stay renting and then buy, and the passive forced on you choice to stay.
All right. Yes. Thanks for that.
Thank you very much. We still have time for a few more questions. Okay, so please join me in thanking Mengi for her presentation.
Thank you very much.